The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
In the last few days, a topic has been on my mind a little bit is the Buddhist teachings on views. And there's the word view in English can mean to, you know, something you see, like the vista you see, but it also means an opinion, a philosophy that you have, a worldview is kind of the fundamental kind of worldview, world kind of philosophy in which someone lives their lives through. And it happens that in Buddha's language, in Pali, they have a word that has this, one word that has both meanings as well. The word ditti also means to see or what's seen, and then it also means an opinion or a philosophy that a person might have. And there's a lot of discussion about views in the early Buddhist tradition. And as I kind of looked into it a little bit, and I think one of the key things I pulled out of there is the question of what's our view about views? What are our beliefs about beliefs? And people seldom step back. A lot of people have beliefs, but people seldom step back to look at what do they believe about beliefs. So an obvious one, for example, is some people believe that their beliefs are true and the only truth. Or people might believe that it's very important to believe, that you have to believe. You have to have an opinion. Some people feel like you can't go to a party without having your opinion ready at hand. You know, what are some of the underlying assumptions behind holding a belief? One of my favorite stories in this regard is from a movie by Woody Allen, where there's this debate. There's this Jewish seder, this Jewish, kind of a whole sacred dinner that they have, meal that they have. And there's a ritual that goes along with it. And so the family, the extended family, is sitting around the table, and they're getting ready for this ritual before they eat. And there's an argument with the father, the head of the family, who is arguing to do the full-blown ritual, which apparently is quite involved. And the young, sometimes called secular daughter, who argues, no, let's just get over it. Let's not do it at all. So they go back and forth. And so finally the daughter says, what do you prefer, the truth or God? Well, that's quite a trade-off. The father says, oh, if I have to choose between the two, I would choose God. Because without God, there'd be chaos, social chaos. There'd be nothing that kept people in line. So here he has a belief in God, but the underlying assumption around the belief in God is that without such a belief, that society is not going to be held together. And you need to have that for social cohesion, for social harmony, for just people getting along. You need to have a very strong, external father figure that is going to judge you. And only by having such a figure can you really, keep everyone in line. So what are the beliefs that you hold around beliefs? I think, a very interesting topic. A lot of people have a lot of beliefs about other people's beliefs and how they hold them. And it can be very hard to turn around and look and see, I don't have any beliefs at all. I just have the truth. We laugh at that, but in fact, I think it's very hard sometimes to differentiate between what we see as the truth and what we believe. Some beliefs are placed in young, tender, impressionable kids' minds. By their family, for example, or in their society, when they're, as they're growing up. And as kids are learning language, learning sense of who they are, learning who the sense of their parents are, their society is, kind of as they're kind of creating and constructing a whole world for themselves as they grow up, kind of entangled or enmeshed in that social creation are some deeply seated beliefs. And it just, for the kids growing up, it just seems that's the way it is. It's so powerful, that's the way it is, that there's no questioning it. It's like, you know, the sky is blue. Zeus is up there with his thunderbolts. Athena is, you know, doing mischief. Poseidon is reigning over the sea. Thor is, you know, looking for his hammer. You know, or whatever. You know, there's a lot. The world has a huge, 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 huge collection of beliefs that people in the past have held as being this is the way it is, that are now for the most part obsolete. There's most people, now very few people believe in Zeus and Thor anymore. There are a few. I don't want to discriminate, there's a few, but it's pretty, you know. But we still have some beliefs which are not obsolete yet. And so, you know, eventually they will be. But, you know, they're deeply embedded, and it's hard to disentangle ourselves from it and to see that it's belief. Buddhists have this. There's certain Buddhists have some deeply held beliefs that some Buddhists will hold on to, and they say this is how things are. It could be argued, perhaps, or said, that the belief in rebirth is one of those things. Growing up in Buddhist cultures, that's a deeply embedded belief that kind of comes along with the whole construction of self and society, and it's inconceivable that it would be any different. And perhaps it's true that there's rebirth, I don't know. But most people who believe in it don't have any evidence for it. So it becomes a belief. It becomes a belief they see as being true. And if we question it, upon what basis do we have that belief? Many people will say, because that's what my religion says, what my society says, what my family has said. My logic says that. It just seems rational that there should be. How could there be life without, you know, how could human beings just appear if there hadn't been something before? Or just feels right, you know, or, you know, I just prefer it that way. It's too bleak if it isn't. And so, so there's all these kind of rationales or reasons for believing what people believe. And what Buddhism asks us to do is to look at how we hold our beliefs and what's behind the beliefs. What are the assumptions and what goes on behind them? And it might be more useful to look at those two questions than it is to look at, is the belief true or false? Because sometimes once you kind of get underneath how you hold it, your relationship to the belief, and the underlying beliefs or ideas that support that belief, if you really address those carefully, then sometimes the original belief becomes maybe irrelevant, maybe not so interesting. So beliefs, opinions, views. So we have this at home, we have this cast iron frying pan that after we wash it, we stick it we fry things in it. But the handle gets really hot because it's also iron, so we put a whole... So a few days ago, I went to pick it up, and it was hot. And you can probably imagine how quickly I removed my hand from it. They say there's these automatic instincts that operate, you know, and I didn't even think about it even. It's just that my hand got released from the frying pan. Did I have to have a belief that removing my hand from the frying pan was a good idea? You know, I have to look at, what did I believe about frying pans and heat and hands? You know, let me think about it. And maybe I should really question my assumptions here about it. You know, I think it was just kind of obvious. It kind of, that releasing from the frying pan doesn't operate at the level of beliefs. My feeling about Buddhism is that Buddhism is not a belief. It doesn't have to be belief at all. It doesn't operate in the realms of belief. But it operates much more in the realm of kind of the obviousness that if you touch the frying pan, you'll release it. If you're doing something that's painful and it's obvious, you'll release yourself from it. You'll stop it. So one of the reasons why we develop mindfulness, cultivate mindfulness and concentration and all these things, is to heighten our sensitivity so that we see with greater subtlety the frying pans we hold on to. So, for example, if I might easily see a frying pan, but say that I feel angry at someone. Can you see and feel the anger so acutely, how it is to be angry, that that your relationship to it is so obvious as it would be touching that hot frying pan? So, oh, that those angry thoughts, angry feelings are coming up. I don't think I want to pick that up. It just hurts to do that. You don't have to have a belief that it's bad to be angry, because you can feel, if you're very sensitive, you feel how that's uncomfortable. Or you might, maybe more subtly, you might see that you're having a conversation with someone and you would like them to think really well of you, like you're really special. And so you say something very subtle. And so, for example, some people will do something like this, where they go out to a restaurant and they say, you know, that burrito stand that I ate at makes the best burritos in all of California. It was really the best place. And, you know, have you gone out and sampled all the burrito shops? You know, it's kind of a little bit, you know, it's kind of like hyperbolic kind of, is that what I was saying? Hyperbolic kind of way of talking. But sometimes when people talk that way, they're just enthusiastic. But sometimes it's a way of saying, I'm special. Now, that's kind of subtle if that's going on. But if we look more deeply, if we're very, very sensitive, you can feel the pain, the burn marks of saying that, of operating that way. And if you're very sensitive, you see that and you let go. Oh, I don't need to go there. So then in relationship to beliefs, if you say, you know, Buddhism is the only true religion. You know, I'm really to go out there and argue with my friends and really show them the true light, and this Buddhism is really where it's at. If you're really, really sensitive, I think the chances are very high that you'll see how that's a frying pan for you. The way you're grasping onto it and holding onto it hurts. And you'll naturally want to let go. Lighten up around your Buddhism, please. And Buddhism is not meant to be held at all. It's not meant to be clutched or clung to. It's not meant to be something we acquire for status, for security, to look good in the eyes of others. It's not. It's not meant to be, to be a counter to other people's beliefs. It's not meant to be a belief that we hold, but rather it's a training in how to become sensitive so that what is natural or obvious can operate for us. So you find a lot of stories where in the ancient texts, the Buddha, someone asks the Buddha, what do you believe? And the Buddha says kind of seemingly cryptic things, at least cryptic for the listener, says things like, I don't need to believe anything anymore. Or, I hold the beliefs that in such a way that there's no cause for me to argue with anybody in the world. He's not putting it against or counter anybody else's beliefs, how he is. And he says, he says very dramatic things at times. He says, encountering people who cling to beliefs, ideas, says, the path of freedom is not found through beliefs. It's not found by tradition. It's not found by virtue. It's not found by spiritual practices. It's not found in texts. But he also says it's not found apart from those things also. But the liberation is found by not clinging, by not holding on to that frying pan. And if you're not holding on to the frying pan, if that's the whole, if that's the focus, if you freed yourself from holding on to the frying pan, why would you pick up a new frying pan? Why would you pick up a new belief system that would cause you to burn? So part of the Buddhist approach to beliefs is, a big part of it is a relationship to beliefs. How do we hold it? And this is a very important issue in a pluralistic society. And I think that in the modern world is very much challenged to try to figure out how all these different belief systems are going to coexist. Because there's, you know, used to be that society was much more homogenous than it is now. And so if, you know, everywhere you went, and you maybe the furthest you ever walked from your village was, 20 miles. And everyone in that 20-mile radius believed the same thing as you. But here, if you walk 20 miles from Redwood City and tallied up all the different religions and beliefs and stuff, you find a big, wide range. So how do we coexist? And so one of the things that Buddhism encourages people to do is for us to look at how do we hold our beliefs? And do we burn ourselves in how we hold it, or do we burn others by how we hold it? And that's part of the problem with beliefs, is we often burn a lot of other people in the process of our having our beliefs. So one of the questions, another way of getting at this question of our relationship to beliefs is, why do we believe? Why do we believe what we believe? What is it, what are we trying to accomplish through those beliefs? And if we can look at that in question, then we can also wonder, are there better ways of accomplishing the same thing? And so again, this is also kind of a direction that Buddhism goes. It says that if what we want is liberation, if we want to set the heart, the mind free, which is one of the happiest things the mind can experience, that happiness does not depend on having beliefs, but rather on the sensitivity that helps the mind let go of its frying pans. Now that's hard to believe, because sometimes you can have, partly because what evidence do you have, and partly because there's very strong beliefs that people carry about what it takes for them to get happy. Often those beliefs come along with the idea that something has to happen for me to be happy. Without something happening, how can I possibly be happy? There has to be, I have to have a friend. I have to have a job. I have to have health. I have to have recreational opportunities. I have to have, something. And the remarkable thing that can be discovered is how little the mind actually needs for it to be happy, to feel secure and safe in itself. So as long as we believe that our happiness is to be found outside of ourselves in having things, then it's very hard to turn the attention around, to turn the attention away from the world of things and people and relationships long enough to develop the inner sensitivity to see where the frying pans are in ourselves, and then let the frying pans cool down and experience the happiness of letting go, non-clinging. So the Buddha said such things as, when people asked him about his beliefs, he said, why should someone who doesn't cling have any concern with beliefs? Isn't that an interesting statement? With views, opinions, philosophies. Now, does that leave Buddhism as being kind of someone who's involved in Buddhist practice spiritually poor or a simpleton. Not left with, you know, it's Buddhism just leaves, you know, just leaves me without no beliefs at all. Just not hold on to anything. How is that going to work as I go about the world? I mean, don't you have to have some beliefs? Don't have to believe in democracy? If I'm going to live here in this country, so I can go vote, and shouldn't I believe in, should believe in dollar bills? It says, in God we trust. So we should believe, you know, aren't there things we're supposed to believe in? So in this regard, Buddhism points out that there are conventions that people share. And those conventions, if we want to operate with other people, it's useful to know what those agreements are and then go along with those agreements if you want to cooperate in some way. And so it isn't so much that we believe in the almighty dollar as it is that we agree to go along with the convention that the dollar means this, means something. Democracy is a convention that we go along and participate in for the greater good. But did it, so then the last thing I want to say is that I believe that there are two major struggles around beliefs in our society. And one is between absolutists, people who believe there are absolute truths, absolute, you know, so often those people tend to be fundamentalists in the religious world. And there are Buddhist fundamentalists. Buddhism is not free from that. And the other might be called relativists. People believe that all truths are relative, or they're conventions. They're created. There's, you know, the very popular word these days, to use critically, is that there's there are secular truths. Heaven forbid that you're secular. And then Stephen Batchelor, who loves the word secular, says secular just means of the times. You know, it's been used in contrast to the sacred or the religious. And, you know, secular values are supposed to be, I don't know what. Secular values is what goes on. You know, that's just really bad. But secular just means values of the times. And those values that are connected to here and now, as opposed to values that are connected to some other time, other place, other world, that has no connection to what's living in here. And so the criticism of some people, the absolutists sometimes criticize the relativists for saying, "This is just, you're just making up your truths. There's nothing really essential here, but you're just making it up, and you can't really do that, or that's not really ultimate." And what I'd like to suggest is that Buddhism is not quite either one. Or maybe it's a hybrid of the two. Because it's not just simply up to us to make up our truths, make up our beliefs and views and stuff like that. Buddhism understands that a lot of beliefs are conventions, a lot of beliefs are created. And it's not exactly absolute in the sense that there's an absolute outside of us, like a God who decrees this is what you should believe. But Buddhism, at the heart of it, it's like releasing your hand from that hot frying pan. That's not exactly a convention that's socially constructed. Oh, it's a relative thing. You know, oh, you should release your hand, you know. That's true in some societies, but not in others. You know, so it's not really a convention. It's not really a social construct. But do we say that it's an absolute truth? It's it's absolutely true. Maybe it doesn't belong to either category, or maybe it is absolute, or maybe what some people like to say, it's a natural law. It's just the way things are. The Dharma sometimes is, the word Dharma sometimes is translated as a natural law. So it's not a belief, it's not a view. But it's a natural law that when you are burning, when you're in pain, you look to relief from that pain. And I said that was the last thing I'll say, but I'll say... That was the last thing I was going to say before I said, say this. Some people might protest this kind of approach to a religious life because it's mostly emphasizes, it doesn't emphasize, it doesn't offer a wonderfully inspiring belief that you can set your course by. It seems to mostly talk about, you know, there's pain, we're getting burned a lot. And that's not a very happy message. And it doesn't seem to offer much, you know, and I'd rather go down the street where they dance with their religion. Well, we should dance too, probably. But I think you can really understand, what I hope you understand is as you develop a heightened sensitivity, heightened mindfulness, how incredibly profound the potential, the possibility is of having a mind, a heart, which doesn't cling. You know, if it's one of the most beautiful things, or I think it's the most beautiful thing that a person can ever witness, is a heart that's set free. You know, it's and so what's I think profound about, I think profound or significant about Buddhism, it points to this profound potential and possibility, without requiring you to have any beliefs. You know, any real metaphysical beliefs or religious beliefs. It helps if you believe that's possible to become free. But that's a little bit different. Like it helps, you know, helps to know it's possible to let go of the frying pan. That's a anyway, so those are my thoughts for today. So we have 10 minutes. So maybe you want to tell me your beliefs. What would you like to have any questions, concerns, protests?
Would you be willing to share with us what was going on in your life and what it was that attracted you to Buddhism?
I can say like four different things that really got me started, or got me involved deeply. The first was that the Vietnam War, and being a pacifist, and feeling that as a pacifist, if I was going to protest the war, that I had to be willing to put my life on the line, and I was afraid to do that, and I was looking for some technique, some way of addressing my fear, so I can live according to my beliefs, you know, the values that I had. So I found Buddhism as a possibility for doing that. At the same time, around the same time, I was going to school at UC Santa Barbara, where they had this huge oil spill down there, and the environmental movement was really taking off, and so I was studying a lot of ecology and was going to be a flaming environmentalist. But as we studied the issues and what my friends and I, and taking classes and stuff, we said, oh, it's not really environmental studies issues. It's political, if you want change. So we took political science classes. After doing that for a while, I said, oh, we can't really do much change politically. What you really need is a change of consciousness. That was the word, the expression back then. And so then we started looking into Eastern religions as a different consciousness, a different way of looking and seeing the world. So that was a second interest. The third was that... I think the hook that really got me was I was living on a large commune, and kind of the Bible on the commune was Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, this book. Since everyone was reading it, I read it. And as I read it, it seemed to, I had this feeling that I had that I was reading my own mind. It's like, you know, wow, this is all stuff that I know, but I'd never thought about before. So it was a kind of feeling of coming home or familiarity or just this is it, kind of. And the book seemed to talk a lot about sitting and meditation. So at some point I started to sit and meditate and just tried it out. And very quickly I felt in meditation, I felt a feeling of rightness, a feeling of freedom, a feeling of relief, a feeling of integrity that was very important for me. And so it was those feelings, that experience that I had, that then pulled me into the world of more and more meditation, and that brought me into the world of Buddhist meditation centers as a way of deepening or expanding out that experience that I was having in meditation. And as I went deeper and deeper into the Buddhist centers, then I kind of went deeper into this Buddhist world. And it wasn't so much the pursuit of Buddhism as it was the pursuit of this freedom that I experienced in meditation, to make it fuller and more deeper. And eventually I was so deeply into all this stuff that I decided that I guess I should call myself Buddhist. Just to make it easier for people. You know, otherwise I have to go through a long explanation of what I was about. They don't want that. People just want to hear, you know, you're Buddhist, and then they can... So is that...
That helps.
Why does it help?
It helps because I don't have to have... You've given me the freedom to not have to cling to a doctrine of any sort, but to enjoy the freedom that the practice has brought me.
Beautiful.
And it's a tremendous gift.
And so I know that we've talked, and I know you're very much involved in another religion. And what's quite beautiful about, I think, about the way Buddhism holds itself as a religion is that because it holds belief so differently than other religions, there's no conflict. It doesn't hold itself in conflict with other beliefs. People are welcome to believe all kinds of things and do this practice of freedom. And so the idea of conflict, I remember once I was a TA at Stanford, TA for religious studies class, and there was a freshman woman from, I think she was like from Tennessee or Arkansas or someplace, and the boonies, and growing up in a very Christian environment. And, you know, she's just, I guess coming to Stanford was her like introduction to a wider world. And there she was taking this religious studies class and had me as a TA. And I said in the discussion, I said that, because we were talking about Buddhism in the class, I said, from the point of view of Buddhism, there's no conflict between being a Christian and a Buddhist. And her eyes got really wide. That was like revolutionary for her.
The Vinaya, which is like 270-some or something, monastic, not beliefs, I guess, but code of conduct.
Yes.
So I'm curious how that kind of goes with what you're talking about, if it does or if it's not related, or because it seems to be held fairly strongly in the monasteries I've been around.
Well, when you go into a kitchen, one of the rules you should live by is that... don't put your hand on the oven, on the stovetop, before you've checked out whether something's on or not. That's a really good rule to live by. So the monks have 227 of those rules. Rules that help them so they don't get burnt. Some of them seem old and archaic. So, they're made up in archaic times. What do you expect? And they were made up in such a way, or the tradition felt that that they had no authority to change them. The tradition decided very early on, right after the Buddha died. See, Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, said, can we change any of these rules? And he said, you can change the minor ones. And then, when Ananda told that, after the Buddha died, Ananda told that to all the other monks, they assembled to talk about this stuff, they said to him, did you ask him which are the minor rules? And he said, no. So they decided that they would err on the side of not changing any of them. And so that's become kind of the, that's been the default for all these centuries. Is let's just stick with these and not be the ones trying to change what the Buddha ordained. So it's it seems a little odd, but if what you do is you see it as rules of training, as opposed to belief, then if those rules of training support the actual training of certain people, then they're useful. If they don't support the training, or if they go in the other direction, then they're not. And they certainly go in the other direction, away from training towards freedom. They train towards slavery, really, if they're held the wrong way. And if they're held lightly in a way, and used in such a way to be supportive. When I was ordained as a monk in Burma, I didn't really do it because of those 227 rules. I didn't really have much high regard for all those rules. I mean, I was going to live by them, but I didn't really think about them much. But I was really surprised, as I lived by the rules, how supportive they were. And some of them do seem archaic, but a number of them had a lot to do with encouraging you to be mindful. And so for example, the monks wear robes, and the hem is supposed to, one of the rules is the hems are supposed to be lined up. And so that's the rule I had to live by, is to keep my hem, my robe hems, lower hems lined up. I had to be pretty mindful, because they were always slipping off those robes. So that was a mindful thing. Or you were told that you couldn't take anything unless it was offered you. And as you know, so if you go into someone's home, like as a layperson, they're going to someone's home, and they have a coffee table book, you know, like on display in their coffee table, you know, it's okay to pick it up and look at it. No one, I think it's kind of understood, right? But as a monastic, you can't do that. You can sit there and look, look down at it, but you can't pick it up. Because, unless they say, here, take a look at the book. And so that's a great training in mindfulness for people who are impulsive. It means that you can't just kind of just impulsively do something. You have to pay attention and notice your impulses and train yourself to wait. Well, last one, please.
What you just said brings to mind for me something that I do, and I've been told, or maybe I've seen, that I should re-examine it. And this rule, the business of looking at the book, I go around having this view that if I think, well, it's okay if I were them and I had a guest and that guest wanted to look at my coffee book on the coffee table, oh, sure, I would be glad to have him. And so my practice is to, it sounds a little arrogant, I guess, when I look at it carefully, that I just say, well, if I were them, it would be perfectly fine. So why should I not do it? But I think there are some, obviously, assumptions going on there that not everyone thinks the way I do and has the values I have, et cetera, et cetera. So I find myself... when I look carefully, being somewhat arrogant in that way.
Well, so. Thank you for telling us. So. I mean, I appreciate that. I mean, it's quite nice to see oneself, see what goes on, and recognize something, and be able to say it in a matter-of-fact way. If that's the case, it speaks well for you. And so one of the things that occurs to me is that if we do have beliefs like this, you know, that if impact other people, is you can check it out with them. That's the, you know, tell them, I have this belief. Is that true? Can I, if you were in my house, you could go into my cupboards and take any food you want. And so I'm assuming that's okay with you. But I, in your house, so... And they say, Okay, so I hope this talk this evening has challenged you some. And that was certainly my hope, for it to kind of challenge you to look at your relationship to beliefs and to question how you hold them, what's going on with them, why you need them, and what are your beliefs around those beliefs. And see if by looking at all that, whether you can find yourself lighter and cooler. Thank you.